aspect of mindfulness is the most powerful, because you, when you practice regularly, you start to notice your patterns. 60% or so of the thoughts that we think every day are outside of our awareness. A bunch of them are pretty negative and not very helpful to where we want to go in our lives.
Great morning, great afternoon, great evening, wherever this conversation finds you. I am Travis Gray. This is Gray Transforms, and we are transforming with another wonderful guest. This is Dr. Laura Bakosh. Laura is a researcher and co-founder of Inner Explorer. Inner Explorer is a mindfulness-based stress reduction education program to develop social and emotional intelligence with children and adolescents, pre-K to 12th grade education. This is a program that is in over 5,000 schools and serves over 2 million students. Laura, how are you?
I am great. Thank you for the introduction and for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really happy to have you because we are alumni of the same university, of what is now Sophia University, but was formerly the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, which personally, I like that name a lot better.
I know I was in at the same time during the shift from one to the other. So
yeah, so that was a tumultuous, transformative time. A lot of us know about that history. We don't need to get into that, but it's really great to have that sort of like connecting bridge. I've been at the school for 10 years, and I think, you know, in this field of transpersonal psychology, it's about transformation. It's about a journey. It's about a process. And that is how I see what the university has unfolded as over the last 10 years that I've been involved. And it's at a wonderful place right now. There's two campuses. There's all kinds of things going on there. So it's really an incredible institution and always growing. So it's really cool, and probably it was tough for you to be at that transitionary phase at that time.
You know, it really wasn't that hard. Okay, interestingly, because I think in the transpersonal space, that's part of the practice that that we all encourage, is kind of being with the change and trying to have that be reflective in, you know, how we interact with one another. So it was probably one of the highlights, in fact, of my career and my life. That was such a transformative time to go from a corporate position. You know, I was sort of in a regular university as an undergrad and did a bunch of years in corporate America. And my education at ITP, now Sophia, was absolutely exactly what I needed at that time to really make this bridge into the nonprofit space that I'm in now. So the other thing that's really interesting for the listeners is part of the reason that I went to Sophia was because I knew to bring something into education, there had to be evidence of effectiveness, right? That is kind of step one in the world of school, especially in the K-12 space. And so part of the journey was actually doing research on the programming that we were developing and trying to bring forth. And what I learned since then is that very few organizations in education have rigorous research associated with their program. So it gave us really a leg up as we approached the market, because we had, by the time I graduated, we had three studies completed in this field in a number of different schools. And that was kind of the jump off point for Inner Explorer.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So it created a great foundation of very practical application of the programs that you are putting into place and creating, co-founding with Inner Explorer. That's really phenomenal. So, I want to, before we go too deep into that, what brought you to, it sounded like you were already answering this question a little bit, but what brought you into the field of transpersonal psychology? How did you become interested in the world of transpersonal?
Yep. So actually 30 years ago now, which is crazy to think about, I worked for GE, and I was struggling, like I think a lot of people do with just a lot of stress and anxiety. And that's what first brought me to mindfulness. So 30 years ago, I found a trainer and I started practicing. You know, I went through a retreat and then began practicing mindfulness every day. And that shifted almost every single thing in my life. And so over the next several years, I became really clear that the simple process of sort of spending time in like a reflective mode every single day was making me healthier, happier, more productive, and more effective. And eventually I ended up teaching, or I brought the trainer in actually to teach my team at GE. And that was kind of the transition point, because over the next couple of years with my team at GE, we saw really incredible business results and really incredible personal results. We had improved loyalty, less transition. Those were the things that really excited me. We had better, you know, numbers, right? Margin and sales and all that kind of stuff. But what I loved the most about what I was witnessing was that people were just happier, more collaborative, more compassionate. And literally at the very same time, research was being done at the University of Wisconsin-Madison by a sort of a superstar researcher named Richie Davidson. And he was showing on functional MRI, which was what GE sold, like it was a GE product that he was using, that people that did these practices had improvements in sort of their brain development and their brain function, like so much so that it was bigger in size and activity. And when you think about having a bigger, more effective brain sounds pretty exciting. So it was kind of those things came together for me. And I said, gosh, if this is happening in the adult world with people on my team, people out in the world that are being researched, imagine what it could do for children if we get to them earlier in the lifespan with, you know, better brain development. I was like, oh my gosh, this could be incredible. So it was sort of taking what was happening with me personally and then figuring out how do I look into this and see if there's some way to do this. And that's what led me to ITP or to Sophia, was kind of, I was already doing it and now I wanted to do it in a broader way and I needed help. And Sophia was kind of the perfect place to do that, because I didn't have to move, which was nice, right? Because they have that blended learning environment. And that was innovative 10 years ago or 15, or, you know, now it's much, much more common. But back then it was still a little bit, you know, people kind of raised the eye. But I found my education there really prepared me, as I mentioned, research already, but also just prepared me for the field in general. I made a ton of contacts and you just start to be able to operate in that different space with a whole bunch of people that are doing great work already and learning from them and you know, helping, you know, make other connections. So it's a really amazing experience. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, that is amazing. So you're, I was not aware of this, the fMRI, that was a GE product. Yeah. That is incredible. Did you have like early access to those tools to utilize in research?
You know, so I did not, because when I left GE, I went straight into, I went into MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction training, and became a trainer through the UMass program. And then I started at ITP, because I started adapting some of the stuff I had learned as an adult to children. And then I went to Sophia ITP to help hone, you know, what I was going to be developing as a program and then how I was going to research it. But my vision still to this day is to try to do some functional MRI research with children. So we actually work closely with researchers at MIT who have access to that equipment and are neuroscientists, but they're hard studies to fund, you know, for obvious reasons. But when that early research was happening at University of Wisconsin, it was on pre-FDA approved product. The functional MRI wasn't FDA approved yet. So they were doing it under these research protocols. And so I'm not sure that many people were paying attention. It was right down the street from where, you know, our office was in Milwaukee. But when that first study came out in 2001, I mean, it's almost 20 years ago now. And still most people don't know that these practices can change the brain in really positive ways.
Yeah. It's incredible how little we do. I had watched your TED Talks. I had watched some of your speaking engagements, and there was one where you were speaking about about just like the impoverished mind of children and being impoverished financially. Actually, it generated into the many generations afterwards. So it was like these children, it becomes an intergenerational problem that is never getting resolved and could be resolved so cheaply. It doesn't require a lot, but these early intervention programs, like it sounds like yours is, and just based on the age range that you're using, that is a form of an early intervention program for a variety of potential illness, mental disorder, potential problems and obstacles that a child might grow into encountering in their lives. I was involved in an early intervention program, a psychoeducation program, during my MFT training. And so I worked for an organization called Piece It Together. We did early intervention, emotional intelligence, psychoeducation for adolescents that were court mandated to this program because of being arrested for different levels of domestic abuse. So it was a teen violence intervention, teen and family violence intervention program. It was like a 6-month program. Some of these, all of them had, it seemed most of them had a background that was a low economic background. It was a result of their an intergenerational impoverished mind and financial resources that led them to these destructive behaviors, these violent behaviors, and the program that we were educating them on, and they were only getting this because of being court mandated, was some of the most valuable education that they were getting in their entire academic career up to that point. So it's really valuable work. Can you tell us more about Inner Explorer and the mindfulness-based stress reduction exercises that you utilize?
Yes, I would be happy to. So one of the things that we often start with when we are sharing the work is to help folks understand, you know, some of the challenges, and you just articulated some of them really well, that there's a lot of poverty in communities, there's a lot of trauma. There's a study called the ACEs study, Adverse Childhood Experiences, you've probably heard of it. And that study was done several years ago by Kaiser Permanente. But what it found is that the majority of kids have had at least some traumatic experiences that lead to changes in their ability to regulate their emotion. So what I often will share, especially with children, is the hand model of the brain. And it's really important because people don't understand is that, as we say, biology before behavior. You can't have great behavior if your biology is all, you know, messed up. So when this hand model of the brain, there's the brain stem, right? Heart rate, digestion, all the things that are automatic. The thumb is tucked in, you know, deep in the brain structure, and that represents the limbic system or the fight, flight, freeze system. And so everybody's heard of that. And then the fingers are the cortex or the cortical structure, and that's sort of where thinking and learning happens, particularly right at the front of my knuckles, which is right behind my forehead, is called the prefrontal cortex. So educators always know prefrontal cortex because that's where we learn math and science and English and reading and so on. So often in school, we're teaching through the prefrontal cortex. 1 + 1 = 2, et cetera. Even most of the social emotional learning content that's delivered into schools, because that is a big area that's come into schools in the last decade or so, is taught similar to how we teach math. So you need to be kind. If you see somebody getting bullied, ask for help, you know, et cetera, right? Still kind of a cognitive process that we're helping kids understand. So what a lot of people don't understand, though, is when the limbic system is triggered, right? I don't have enough to eat. I was scared walking to school because I had to walk through a gang, you know, fight or a drug situation. I have a test that I'm freaking out about. My friend didn't invite me to the party last weekend and I'm distraught about it. For all of those reasons, the limbic system is triggered. And when the limbic system triggers, the thinking part of the brain literally goes offline. So Richie Davidson and these other neuroscientists have shown over the last 2 decades that when the limbic system is fired, so it's very active, the thinking brain goes dark. So we say to kids, it's like you flipped your lid. And we ask and think, you know, for a moment, can you ever remember a time where you said or you did something that you later regretted? And of course, every single hand goes up. Like, we all have had those experiences. Somebody cuts us off and we flip them off, or we honk the horn and we're, you know, super mad, or somebody, you know, in our household even may say something that really triggers us and we sort of react. And that's this. We flip our lid. Now, as adults, our prefrontal cortex continues to develop and we learn regulation skills. However, if you are growing up in an environment like you just described, right, for these kids that end up in juvenile justice situations, they have an overactive limbic system because they're in environments that are pretty darn challenging for kids to navigate, right? So their limbic system's fired up all the time. And what happens in the brain during adolescence is whatever's used gets strengthened, right? So you're using the limbic system, you're always in fight or flight mode. Well, that becomes a superhighway. And, you know, in terms of what's happening in the development of the brain. And then the brain says, oh, this smart part that really matters for like thinking, learning, and success in life, we're going to prune that because you don't need it. So during adolescence, this pruning, and they call it myelination, so strengthening of the pathways, that happens to all of us, regardless of what we think it should happen. It happens, and it doesn't care. It doesn't say like, oh, well, this is the smart part, I'm going to leave it. The brain's like, you don't use it, boom, it's gone. You use this, boom, it's stronger. So think about kids in urban environments and high poverty environments. What's going to happen next? They can't think and they're triggered, right? So they're going to get in trouble. They're going to be involved in juvenile detention and juvenile justice, and maybe worse, maybe prison. And they're not going to have the cognitive resources to actually be successful in school and find a path out. The best way to break the cycle of poverty is through education. And yet, when these brain changes are happening unencumbered, they can't get an education. And in, again, most people don't know this, but over 60% of US children, every grade, everywhere, every state, more than 60% are below grade level. 60%. It's actually 63%.
Below grade level in all.
Every subject measured, reading, math, and science. So whether you're at a third grade or a fifth grade or an eighth grade, more than 60% on average. So yeah, there's school districts in high income areas that do a lot better, but we have a lot of kids in urban communities like Detroit and Chicago and, you know, lots of places that are way, way below that. So they're more like 80% of the kids. So anyway, the reason I'm going into that level of detail is that mindfulness is a perfect countermeasure to what I just described is existing across the country, which is high stress and high trauma without a way to mitigate it. So mindfulness, when you practice every day, lowers arousal in the limbic system. So we see that in functional MRI. It improves activity in the prefrontal cortex, makes it bigger and more active, which is the part that we care about. Prefrontal cortex is the executive center of the brain. I mean, it really, really matters. So these practices do that, and we're still going to trigger sometimes, right? We're all still going to have the car crash or the whatever, but mindfulness is also proven to speed up the time from when we trigger to when we come back on to be able to think clearly, which helps us not make as many mistakes, right? Being reactive and punching a wall when really, you know, we can settle ourselves because we're back to thinking more quickly. So in our work, it's just about bringing these tools into every school easily, inexpensively, and effectively so that teachers can hit a button. So our program is fully automated. Teachers log in, press a button. It's 5 or 10 minutes a day. So they listen along with the students, and it's already preformed based on MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction. So it's a world-recognized protocol. It's been around for 40 years. There's tons of research on it. And so it's probably the simplest thing that a teacher can do to improve his or her classroom climate. And actually, you know, besides student stress, which is a big deal, teachers have a huge amount of stress. Anybody with kids knows that there's a big problem with teacher turnover because it's a really hard job. And so this program actually benefits both the teachers and the students, you know, at the same time. And lastly, in education, there is a lot of churn about parent involvement, right? More parents want to understand, they want more transparency, and part of our approach gives free access to parents. So a student is in a classroom, they're listening with their class and their teacher, and any parent that wants access can opt in, and then they automatically get a click on their device that the practices, they have access to that same exact practice. So kind of creates this beautiful cycle where the whole family can get involved and it improves, sort of health, mental health and well-being.
That is incredible. I didn't expect to hear how that was going to reach out to the parents as well. I love that it is including the teachers. The teachers are automatically going to be involved in the program. Ideally, if they're turning it on for their classrooms, these children, the early intervention, the generative value of giving these exercises to children is immense. If we want to be a nation or a society or a species of human beings that desire the best of what we can have for our human beings, for our fellow man and woman, our fellow human beings, then we need to be mitigating some of the some of that blowing the top off. We need to have a better understanding and practices that are going to develop our prefrontal cortex for being able to have a better attentiveness and an awareness of ourselves, an able to reduce the stress that we're experiencing from things that are very unnatural, like social media or yes. like seeing all of this news and all of this all of this war and chaos, and it's very unnatural to see all of that so often, and having these tools is so important. And then I was also thinking that this is also why children are getting involved in early substance abuse. They are self-medicating those same reptilian brain structures that are in fight or flight all the time. They're looking for a way out. They're looking for a way to calm those things, but like you said, through education is going to be the best way for them to actually get that result. It's interesting that mindfulness gives us better access, meditation, mindfulness, these things give us better access to our ability to act in responsibility and act in our everyday life. And it seems counterintuitive because you just sit and do less, and it gives you more access to doing more. What would you say is there a difference? What would you say is the difference between a mindfulness exercise and a meditation exercise? There's a really great article called Mind the Hype, and this article looked at how popular discourse is using these different terms, meditation, mindfulness. What would you say is the difference between those? What are these students actually doing in a class?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I can share, an actual mini practice that we've videotaped. Sure. So I can share that after, but, it's a really important question because the names are used sort of synonymously. There are differentiators. What I would say is meditation is kind of a very broad topic. So you get the mantra meditations and the transcendental meditations, and there's a whole bunch of different versions, and they philosophically have differences, of course, and maybe all trying to get to the same thing, which is sort of a settling and an understanding of self. Mindfulness, and we really only use that word. We almost never use the word meditation because there's so much misunderstanding about it. But mindfulness is really a specific practice, I should say set of practices. But the part that we focus on is what's called like the formal mindfulness practices, so formal sitting. And because we are implementing it in schools, we do some chair movement that's mindful movement, but not, a whole bunch of movements, because we want it to be short and simple for teachers to be able to use without a lot of, expertise. So the key, I would say there's two keys. One is that with a sitting practice where we're inviting kids to either close their eyes or look downward, whatever's most comfortable, you have a almost immediate settling of the central nervous system, right? So there's almost an immediate stress reduction effect, not always, but usually. And so that does a lot of things biologically that are pretty helpful for the brain and the body, right? Part of, as you I'm sure know, most physical and mental health ailments have a strong connection in stress, right? Stress is a cause of things like fibromyalgia and diabetes, and that there's implications of stress and cancer, heart disease, you name it, right? Stroke. So settling the stress response in the body is a really, really amazing, and you feel it pretty quickly when you start to practice. The second part of mindfulness that's not well understood is the part that the participants are invited to simply be aware of thoughts and emotions and various things as they come and go. And we teach kids, it's called meta-awareness or awareness of awareness. We teach kids through the sequence how to notice those things with a sense of openness or kindness or curiosity. Like, not like, I shouldn't have done this, or why am I doing, you know, I'm not focused on my breathing and I'm making a mistake. So we teach them how to kind of leave that behind and just kind of notice. And as you learn to notice, you don't hook into the next thing. I have to make a list because I forgot, you know, whatever. You just say, oh, there's a thought about a list. And then you kind of come back to breathing. Oh, there's a thought. And that aspect of mindfulness is the most powerful, because when you practice regularly, you start to notice your patterns. 60% or so of the thoughts that we think every day are outside of our awareness. A bunch of them are pretty negative and not very helpful to where we want to go in our lives. So when you start to bring consciousness to the unconscious, that's where you start to be able to work on it. So if I, from my family of origin, let's say I was always told I was the dumb one in the family. I'm not going to say whether that's true or not, but but let's say that's the case. So that thought pattern is probably happening without me questioning and without me even realizing, like, oh, you're the dumb one. You can't do that. Oh, you're the dumb one. And so I have a lifetime of that. And now as I practice and I hear, you know, I kind of witness that thought pattern coming back and back, then I can say, well, am I, but maybe I was the dumb one. Maybe I'm not anymore. Maybe like you start to be able to reframe it from a place of deep understanding, right? If I felt this way about myself and somebody said to me, but you're not the dumb one, you're plenty smart, I wouldn't believe it. Just like when somebody says, you're great. I mean, people that are suicidal, you're so great. Why would you want to end your life? Like, that doesn't help anybody. It just doesn't. You need to understand yourself from a really deep place to start to be able to unravel some of those negative patterns. And suicide as a topic is, you know, we talk about it as habits of mind, right? So mindfulness gives us a chance to deeply understand our habits of mind and then to start to be able to work with them more skillfully. Suicide ideation, addiction, as you pointed out, are escape patterns to avoid the deep pain that we're feeling based on whatever traumas might be there. And there's to believe that you're better off dead is a misalignment, right, of reality. Like, you're not better off dead, but some people believe they are, and that's why they proceed in that way. So when you start to unravel why you think that, you can start to work through things that may be false about, you know, your current belief system. So there's really interesting research on suicide ideation and addiction and mindfulness, because it all is getting to the same thing, which is these habits of mind and how to be able to unravel them from a deep understanding. No one can do the work for you, though, unfortunately. Like, it's a practice you have to commit to in order to get to that point.
Absolutely. So it mindfulness, you are filling your mind with awareness. You are observing the weather of the mind. And at times you are weathering the storm. At times there is a lot of chaos going on. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, like you said, a lot of that can be very unconscious, and it can, those patterns of getting away patterns, the ways in which we, you know, self-medicate or isolate ourselves, or we do these things that can look like a lot of different ways to react to our fight or flight responses. And that is like, how do we bring that lid back on? How do we bring that lid back online? so that we can have, you know, some awareness that is you know, based in a little bit more reality. When you know, maybe you did go through a challenging experience with that test. Maybe that test was difficult, but to give up the rest of the semester because you didn't do well on that one test, that's not a thinking that is based in reality. That is a thinking probably because you heard it from outside of yourself, that somebody had done that before, had failed the test, and so they let the rest of their school academic career go to the wayside. It's really beautiful that all of these exercises that you're bringing to people, and really a great way to describe the differences between meditation and mindfulness. Meditation has a lot of different philosophical approaches. It's very umbrella term. Mm-hmm. But mindfulness is a lot simpler, and it's a more digestible word. It's more digestible articulation, especially for children what did you do today? I meditated. Oh, what does that mean? Well, I was mindful today. There's just a little bit more groundedness. I can sit in that a little better.
Yeah. One other thing that's important to notice too is, and I've heard this, I wish, probably 10,000 times, people say, I can't meditate because I can't clear my mind. And that is exactly not what mindfulness is. So maybe I'm not an expert in all versions of meditation, but in mindfulness, you don't want to clear your mind. You want to notice, as we just described, like what's happening, and start to just pay attention to those patterns. Now, as you practice more and more, that chattering of, like anxiety-filled thought patterns, that does start to slow down. There's great research that mindfulness reduces anxiety and depression more so than meds. Like that's like an astounding finding that's been out there for a decade, but we still keep prescribing everybody meds first. Maybe there needs to be a little of both, but it isn't about clearing the mind. It's about paying attention to what's in there. And I want to just tell a story, if you don't mind, because this might help gel it, that we work in a school in Connecticut, just outside of Hartford. And this particular school is for kids who cannot be successful in the regular classrooms, right? They have a lot of behavior problems. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of different things happening, and certainly tons of trauma with this group of kids. And they frame this as like the last step before juvenile detention. So these kids are, having challenges. And so the principal of the school several years ago kind of brought us in. We met and she said, hey, we want to do this. And she was phenomenal about implementing it in every classroom in the school. And they had a 68% reduction in the behavior problems, which they call restraint and seclusion practices, right? So these kids aren't just in detention, like they're getting restrained because they're highly active when they're upset. And so they had this huge reduction that carried all the way through COVID. So during the COVID years, once kids have been back, most schools are reporting a huge increase in behavior problems, as you may or may not know. It's definitely a thing. And most school districts are saying not only is there more behavior problems, but they're worse, like we're having a lot more violence. And this is a result of like a chronic stress environment that we've all been living with for a couple of years now. So, but the other notable thing, so great, improvements in behavior, kids are more regulated. That all makes sense for what mindfulness does. But the principal said to me, these kids were all sort of failing, all the standardized tests and stuff. And she's like, now they're doing as well as some of the best schools in Hartford. Like these kids are like A and B students now. And she said, what's been so transformative is like kids get like pigeonholed, right? You're a bad kid and you got to go to this school and whatever, and you're in trouble all the time. And she's like, there's just this transformation. She said one kid had 200 like calls to his parents like the year before. And the mom called and said, are you guys mad at me? Like, I never talk to you anymore. And the principal's like, we just don't need to call you anymore because like your kid is totally succeeding. And that's like, we see that transformation in less than a year. Like when you think about what's happening in our world today and you compare that to what's possible with something that's so simple and so accessible and so affordable, you know, I spend part of my day banging my head against the wall saying we have to hurry up, because there's no reason why we wouldn't just be doing this in every school already. And that's kind of the work. That's our next few years, is to get it embedded just like math. You know, we brush our teeth every day to protect our teeth. We need to do mindfulness every day to protect our brain.
Wow. That's so inspiring. It's so, it is so affordable, so easy, such a quick turnaround in behavior and effectiveness and benefit to the child, to the individual that is involved in these exercises. It's 5 to 10 minutes a day. It's not interrupting a whole curriculum but sometimes some schools, some frame of thought, some frame of thinking somehow believes that things like this is totally interrupting the entire curriculum. And, mm-hmm. you know, they kind of sometimes can associate it with being like a dwarf school,
like a Waldorf school.
Yeah, a Waldorf school. Yeah. They're like, oh, we would be becoming a whole different, you know, academic institution. We'd be a whole different thing than what we are. But right. but you're not. You're mm-hmm. giving access to a tool that is going to make your students more effective in all math and science and reading and social interaction with other students. You'll have less violence in the classroom and in the schools. You'll have less problems. It'll be easier for the teachers, more enjoyable. People like earlier when you were mentioning the value that it had in your experience at GE, it created more loyalty in the business. I teach the MBA program at Sophia University, and I had a great conversation with a mutual friend of ours that is a former executive at LinkedIn and brought those mindfulness programs to Silicon Valley and into LinkedIn. It's incredible that this is so easy, so accessible, and yet, like you said, banging your head against the wall. Like, why is this not happening faster?
I know.
What do you think might what would make it happen faster? What could we do in this conversation that would make it happen faster? What would the local governments or a national government, what influence could that have to make these things more accessible?
That's such a good question too. So I don't know for sure, but I think it has more to do with awareness than anything else. So I'm so happy to be joining you today, because this is a pathway to build awareness to a whole bunch of different folks that we don't normally have a chance to, you know, interact with. So I think if every parent and every, you know, even if you're not a parent yourself, you might be an aunt or an uncle or whatever. But if every person knew that not only would we be preparing children more effectively with their brain and their body to succeed in life, and if they knew that they would have 15%+ higher academic performance, which is what all the research shows on our program, like kids are doing better in math, science, reading, like across subjects, makes sense, right? Their brains are more settled, they're more focused, and so they do better. So if people knew that like every kid in America could be doing 15% better, like out of the gate, and having far fewer behavior problems, far fewer suspensions and bullying and all of the things, violence that goes along with it, it like overnight, by just saying yes, right, in your local school district, that I think people would jump on that. And if you're in a district that doesn't do mindfulness every day, because a lot of people are like, we have a mindful room, so when kids are falling apart, they go to the room. That's like saying I'm going to brush my one tooth with a cavity. Like, don't. I mean, it's not bad, but it's not going to solve the problem that we have. But you know, talk to your school board, talk to, you know, your kids' teachers, and see if you can, you know, build some momentum. Invite us in, or at least, you know, we're happy to work with anybody that wants to talk about this and potentially even try it, because it's so effective. In our very first research study, after 3 weeks, the principal of one of the schools called me and said, all the teachers want it. So we were doing a controlled trial. So some teachers did it and some teachers didn't. And she's like, all the teachers want to do it. And I said, you can't, because we're in the middle of the study. But within 3 weeks, she said the other teachers were noticing huge changes on the playground. Kids weren't fighting. Kids weren't screaming. Like, it was just a much healthier, happier environment. So in 3 weeks, like, people are seeing change. And then the academic changes maybe after, you know, less than a year. So,
and there are studies that have proven the effectiveness of this. The 15% change in academic performance, this is, you know, early intervention. Those are potentially compounding interest percentages, right?
Right.
It's such a quick turnaround. If in first grade I had a 15% increase in my academic ability or in my social ability or all of the different ways that this can potentially benefit me, I am going to be that much better going into second grade, into third grade, into the rest of my educational career. And then that is going to, it's just going to continue to be a rippling effect for the betterment of society as a whole. But it's also never too late. It's never too late to be involved in these programs yourself, to be involved in a 10 minute meditation. Mm-hmm. Like you said earlier, I really love getting clients that say that they've never meditated before because they can't. I love that's what I do. I teach people meditation that believe that they cannot meditate. Mm-hmm. The quote is like, you should meditate for 20 minutes a day. If you don't have enough time, then you should meditate for an hour.
Yes, exactly.
You should take some more time to really break down the reality of that sort of thinking. It's not really a realistic thought that you don't have this 5 or 10 minutes when you're spending a lot more than 5 or 10 minutes on your social media, on other, you know, distractive behaviors and activities. This is really phenomenal. I think that there's so much value and inspiration that people will get from this. I wonder if I could ask maybe an ending question here. What would you say to people that aspire to have organizations like yours, to create an organization like yours, or maybe they have an idea of this of a mindfulness-based stress reduction program that they want to bring into their schools? They're just trying to reach a school that you couldn't get to, or something like this. How would you advise that sort of person?
I would say, yes, go do it. There are a lot of people in this field, but nowhere near enough. Right? There are 60 million kids in the preschool through 12 in just this country. And there's 1.5 billion kids around the world. And if you believe, like we do, that, and as you just described, getting to kids early and consistently throughout the lifespan with practices and tools that are proven to improve brain development and mental health. Like, we should be doing this everywhere all the time. And we need, you know, a group of, like, it's way bigger than one organization. We work with a lot of partners around the country that do direct training. We have sort of the automated approach, and together that I think is ideal, but there just aren't enough people to get into every school and to get into every classroom. So the more people that are doing different things, the better. And I encourage anybody that's interested, reach out to us, because, you know, we've been doing this a little bit more than 10 years. We've learned, you know, the hard way in some ways. But there's plenty of room, and there's a huge need. Kids need us. Like, nobody can be sitting on the sidelines at this point, because that's our future, like, truly. And when 60% plus or below grade level in every subject, that scares me, because that means a whole bunch of kids aren't reaching their potential and potentially are being harmed. And we have to hurry up. And the world is not getting less complicated. It's getting more complicated. And there's so much more stress that is bound to keep pushing down. So while 10 years ago, you know, we're doing our thing, now I feel like we have to do this faster, and we have to do this with more people. So I really encourage anybody that's interested to jump in. Yeah. It's fun in here.
It's relatively low effort to get this into programs and things like this once it's put in. It's amazing. Thank you so much for all the work that you are doing, Laura Bakash. I really appreciate this conversation. How should people reach out to you? Is it Inner Explorer? Is there a website? How should people reach out to you?
So innerexplorer.org is our website, and you can reach out to also at laura@innerexplorer.org. And that goes to me and to our marketing team so that we can, because I, you know, I sometimes don't have time for every message, but they, all the ones that need me or are guided to me will get to me. So
yeah. Amazing. I'm inspired, and I really appreciate receiving your genuine compassion for these students and a genuine desire to serve these students, a future generation. This is our society. This is our human beings that are going to be, you know, in a world that is continuing progressively getting more complicated. And we want them to have the best foot forward. It's not great knowing that there are unfortunately a great majority of students that are not able to reach their fullest potential because of not having even simple things like this. Thank you so much, Laura. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I've loved the conversation. I really appreciate your time too. So thank you. You think who is this man talking? I'm talking.